the activity today. I claim that this talk would be a romp. I don't know if that's true, but we'll see. So the prerequisites for this talk are going to be linear algebra, basic algebra, basic abstract algebra, and then maybe a little bit of topology. The difficulty will basically increase over the course of the talk, so hopefully you'll understand at least like maybe like a first half, and then you can zone out. I don't really care. And the reason I know about this topic is through the RU at University of Minnesota Twin Cities. And because I'm giving this talk, I guess I'm contractually obligated to say that it's just as good as Duluth, if not better. One of the top combinatorics RUs in Minnesota. But whatever, let's get started. So we're looking at matrices, and they're going to be in GLN of R. So we're just looking at n by n invertible matrices. And some brief notation, we're going to be talking about Myers. So I will use this bracket to mean the set of 1 through n. And if we have some matrix, and I want to consider some submatrix, well, how do we do that? What we do is we pick some subset of rows and some subset of columns, so they don't have to be contiguous or anything. And then what we do is we basically look at when they intersect. And the places where they intersect is going to form our submatrix. So if we call this subset R, so this is our subset of 1 through n, and this is also a subset of 1 through n, then this submatrix will be denoted A sub R, comma S. Cool? And when these are the same cardinality, we can take the determinant. So that's going to take all these. And the determinant of such a submatrix is called a Myers. You probably know it from like expansion of Myers. And I guess there the formula you take out rows, but we're gonna index by the rows. So. And now from there we can just define a totally unnumbered matrix. A matrix A and GLN of R is totally non-negative. And then we can also define a totally positive matrix if all its Myers are non-negative or positive. Okay, so I guess once you look at this definition, the first question you might ask is, why do I care about this? Maybe since this is math, you might not ask that question, but it's an important question to ask. And I mean, we're looking at Myers. I don't really know if these are important or if this thing comes up a lot or anything like that. But it actually does come up a lot. So I think this was first seen, the property like this was first discussed in the context of mechanical systems, oscillations in mechanical systems. I think how it works is that you have some matrix that represents a system, and like powers represent an oscillation, and then maybe eventually you hit something that's totally positive or something like that. But it comes up in a lot of other places. Representation theory, there are sequences, you can define total non-negativity on a sequence. Just various stochastic processes. So these things show up, and we want to know what do they look like. And that's the other question, right? Because is it like, just from looking at the definition, it's not even obvious that any totally non-negative or totally positive matrix exists. So can somebody give me an example of a totally non-negative matrix?
Yeah, just take it to be all zeros. Right.
All zeros? Well, we're in GLN.
Oh, okay.
So just top-down ideas?
I mean, the one-by-one matrix with one.
Okay, that's good, yeah. A for A greater than zero. That's totally not the matrix. It's also totally positive, so good job. I'll give you another one. The identity matrix is totally positive. But totally not negative. It might not be immediately obvious, but all of the minors are either valued 0 or 1. And similarly, we can say the diagonal matrices these are totally non-negative. Now, in terms of totally positive,
diagonal matrices with positive.
Yeah, with positive entries. So for totally positive, I don't exactly have a good example for you that works for arbitrary n. I can give one example. So if we use an example. There's a 3x3 one. Do they exist for any n? We'll see through the talk that they are, but there's no way you can tell just from looking at this. At least maybe you have to do some other things. So typically whenever we want, when you're studying math, you come across a property, at least like a combinatorial object or something like that, and you want to see if something like that exists. There are a couple ways of doing that. One way is to sort of use some sort of probabilistic test. You could say, I generate something randomly. What's the probability that it satisfies this property? And using that, you can show that these can exist, and maybe you can show that, maybe even find a way of generating it. Another way would just be to figure out the structure that something of that object would have, and then sort of use that to build arbitrary objects with that structure. So if I told you, give me a matrix of determinant 1, you would be able to do it, not because you're just guessing randomly, but because you actually construct it so that it has the desired property. And so the second thing is what we're going to do. The reason I mentioned the first aspect is that that's actually an interesting question in this context as well. So we're going to start with an identity. So this is called Cauchy Binet. There is another identity called Binet-Cauchy. It's not the same. So what this says is that if you have two matrices, one is n by n, and then the other is m by n, and you require n to be less than or equal to m, then you could say that the determinant of xy is equal to the sum over subsets of m that are size n, and then use the product of two minors. Okay, what does this mean? So we have x. X is n by m for n less than or equal to m, so that means it's y. And then y is tall. Okay, so this is n. This is x, this is y. So we want to know the determinant of the product, which is going to be small, so it's going to be n by n. And what I say is that you can compute it by summing over subsets, and then you, it's like a product of the determinants of these subsets. So for example, I can choose J to be like this collection of columns. And then so the corresponding thing here in the Y would be basically the thing that like flipped over. So it would be, I guess, look like this. And something like here. And so indexing by this J gives us square sub matrices. So we can take their determinants. And I claim that if you sum all of them up, well, you take the product and then you sum all possible, over all possible cubes. And then this will give you the determinant of this. I don't know actually an easy way to prove this off the bat, but it's really important for basically all aspects of analyzing totally non-human species. So, and what we are going to do is we're going to notice that if we have two matrices, A and B, and these are in GLN, so these are, I guess, N by N, that are totally non-negative. I'm going to treat it as T and N. This is AB. You want to know what the minors are for AB. Hopefully they're all non-negative. So if we look at some submatrix, what this actually is it's the product of these two things. So if this is indexed by R and S, this is indexed by S, and this is indexed by R. You can see this just from looking at like the formula for matrix multiplication. To get the entries in here, you only need the entries in these submatrices. And if we want to find the determinant of this, we know that it's the product of these two. So we can use Cauchy-Binet because it satisfies all of the requirements here. And what Cauchy-Binet says is that this determinant of this can be expressed as the sum of minors here times minors here. And that means that it's non-negative. So we get the result that totally non-negative matrices and also totally positive matrices form a semigroup. So semigroup, just for those who aren't aware, basically it just means that it satisfies exactly this property. That if A and B are both totally non-negative, then their product is in favor of totally positive. Okay, so this is good. We have a semi-group. We have some structure to the space. Now, our question is, what are the generators of this? And it's somewhat not obvious, but the answer is actually very simple. So by Lohner, with me, say totally non-negative matrices are generated by, I'm going to write that down some notation and then define it. So FEIs, FIs, and HIs. Okay, what are these? Okay, for A greater than 0. What are these? These are elementary Jacobi matrices. So the EIs, they have one from the diagonal, and then in the I row, there is A. So this is EA. A. For Fi of A, it's just the transpose. So in the I column, there's an A right below the diagonal. And HI is just the diagonal matrix. A, this is I. Okay, is everything clear so far? Yeah.
How's a semigroup different than normally?
A semigroup doesn't require identity. This is a monoid, but totally positive matrices are not a monoid. Right, so that's good, we have generators. How do you prove this? It's actually kind of very elementary, actually. So If we go back to our example that we had before, what an EI does is it adds one column to the row above it. So, for example, if you multiply this by, you know, E1, it would add the second row to the first row. And the Fs would do the same but for the row below. And then the Hs are just scaling. So essentially what we have is we just have elementary row operations with the restriction that we can only do things that are like adjacent. And also you can do column operations by pulling to the right, by multiplying on the right instead of the left. So basically we just have everything that you would expect from an elementary row operation. And so what we can do is we can take any matrix that's totally positive or totally non-negative, and we can use a row operation, we can factor out EIs. So for example, we could send this to, we can remove half of this column from this column. So we can say this is equal to 2, 0.50, 2, 3, 2, 1, 2, 3. And this is just by multiplying on the So basically you factor it out, and then you're left with an entry that's zero now. And you can basically just continue doing this. You can make this zero, you can make this zero, you can make all of these zero. And then what you get at the end is a diagonal matrix. So those are your HIs. And so basically what you do is you use Poqubit A to just prove that you can do this. So it's basically very straightforward. Okay, so we've done this. We have generators. But we're not quite happy, because what you need with generators, you need relations, right? So what are these? So what we'll do is we will restrict to EIs. I am doing this because the relation between E's and F's, and then between things of different letters in general, are not very interested. So this is the most interesting case. Everything else basically just follows this. And I will give some relations. So I'm just gonna, I guess, give a few obvious ones. So this one, if you add a multiple, like A times one row to a row above, and then B times, then you've added A plus B copies of the row. Self-explanatory. This is a braid relation. So what I'm saying is that if your letters are if your indices are the same, then they just combine. If they're one apart, they satisfy this thing. If they're more than one apart, they just pass by each other. So, you know, if I give you some expression that looks like this, you can just use these to go between anything that you really want. And so from here there, the question is, do we have all of the relations? Essentially, what I'm saying is that, is it possible that there is a relation that cannot be achieved through any of these operations? And we'll try to answer that question. But first, there's something to notice about these relations that we have right here. And how we do it is we consider a parameter map. So these ABCs, we are calling them parameters because they can be basically anything greater than a zero. And what we can define for some word, we can say W is a word in EIs. So by that I just mean like EI, EI plus one EI is a word in the EIs. And any word defines a parameter map, so we'll call it X. And I'll give the example for this one. So I'll give the example for EI, EI plus 1, EI. And what it does is it sends the parameters to the space of totally non-negative matrices. How does it do this? Well, I guess the obvious way. It maps ABC to EI of A, EI plus 1, EIC. So basically, we're setting the parameters to the things that they parameterize, which is kind of obvious. And something to note about this relation here, is that this map, the thing defined by this relation, if you just look at the parameters, can people see this look? Okay, it should be good. If we send it to the thing that we end up with in the result, this has a few good properties. First of all, it's subtraction free. What does that mean? That means that if you start with positive things here, you're going to get positive things here because there are no minus signs. And the second thing is that it's bijective. So it's bijective from this to itself. This might be a little bit less obvious, but you can just compute the inverse by looking at these functions and then just sort of manipulating things. And so what this means is that, the image of XEI, EI plus 1, EI is the same as the image of XEI plus 1, EI, EI plus 1. Because I can take any of these parameters to any other set of parameters, the images must be the same correspondingly. Is that clear? Or is it? Okay, cool. And what this means is that basically, when we, you can say the same thing about this EI, EJ, EJ, EI. I guess it's more obvious in this case. And these two relations together mean that we can basically consider words without any regard for these parameters. And what I mean by that is that we can define an equivalence relation, right? We can say that two words, W1 and W2, are equivalent exactly when the image of their parameter maps are equal. Okay? And these two define the equivalence relation here. So from this equivalence relation, we know that, you know, EI, EI plus 1, EI is equivalent to EI plus 1, EI, EI plus 1. And EI, EJ is equivalent to EJ, EI. Okay, this is good. But what exactly am I doing here? Well, I'm trying to get these things that appear here in basically like their the form that makes the most sense, right? There's some notion in which these parameters, although they're some like I guess they're important if you want to actually figure out the exact values, they don't really like they're not really core to the structure of the space of totally non -zero matrices. And these words are sort of what's actually going on. And from this equivalence relation, there are a couple of questions. First of all, we still haven't answered the question of whether these are all the relations, so I may have just defined something that's completely like stupid. Like maybe I'm missing something, and then this doesn't mean anything anymore because maybe it's not subtraction free and I can't do anything with it. Okay? And the other thing that you would ask is whether this reflects something deeper. Like, there's a question that naturally arises, which is, if W1 is not congruent, I guess I'll just do this, to W2, does that mean that their images are disjoint? So both there are these questions that you should, I guess, think about in your head while I define this thing completely arbitrarily. And while we move on to a completely different subject. Cool. Okay. So now we will head into the algebra portion of our talk. Some more notation. We're going to be looking at Sn, so the space of permutations. And what we want to look at is I'm going to be using one-line notation, which means that for some sigma in Sn, we notate it by sigma of 1. Right, because so for example, the identity would be 1, 2, 3. This is not cycle notation. So basically, that's all I want to impart to you. And the other thing is that we will use function composition for multiplication. There are different conventions, but what we'll say is that sigma times gamma of n is going to be equal to sigma of gamma of n. So that's basically all that we're getting. Okay, so what's the generating set of Sn?
Transpositions.
All right, anything else?
Transposition and insight.
That's pretty good. Anything else? I'm looking for a specific answer.
And you could take all of Sn.
That's pretty good as well. I mean, you're getting what you want, I suppose. What we're actually going to do is do something completely different from all of this. We're going to view Sn as a Coxeter group. So G is a Coxeter group. If it has representation or presentation, right? It's not a representation. What is this? We have a bunch of generators. And then the relations are looked like this. For Mij, Mij is greater than or equal to 2, therefore I not equal to j, and then m I j is equal to 1 when I equals to j, or I is equal to 1. So what I'm saying is that all of these generators have order 2, and they satisfy these relations, basically saying if you take a multiple of two, like a product of two of them, and then raise it to a high enough power, raise it to m the mij power, you get back to the identity. Okay, so how can we write Sn as a Coxeter group? Well, maybe the better question maybe is, why do we care about Coxeter groups? The answer is, I'm not really sure. It has a lot of very interesting properties regarding factorizations, and it appears when you're studying V groups. So in a lot of cases, the things that arise will be Coxeter groups, and you care about a lot of the structure is surprisingly similar for basically any choice of these MIJs. And so there's a lot of theory in that regard. And so we can write Sn as, so what we'll take is we'll take EI to be equal to 1 through I minus 1, and then we swap I and I plus 1. So I plus 1, I, and I plus 2, through N. In cycle notation, this is just I plus 1. And so what we can say is that Sn is equal to these EIs for I between 1 and minus 1. And so we'll say EI is equal to 1. We'll say EI plus 1 cubed is equal to 1, and then we'll say EI EJ squared is equal to 1. For I minus J bigger than 1. So this is what happens when they're the same, this is what happens when they're 1 apart, this is what happens when they're 2 apart. And what properties does Sn have with given this? So I've sort of like been vague about what the Coxeter group does for you. What we can do is we can define the length of some permutation to be the length of the minimal number of generators in a factorization of sigma. So I'm claiming that these generate. It shouldn't be that hard to see. And because of this, you can write sigma as a product of these EIs. And I want to take something that's minimal in the number of generators that it uses. And I'm calling this the length function on Sn. And something interesting, a few interesting things, is that length of sigma is the number of inversions of sigma. So what is this? It's the number of ij, or I less than j, and we want sigma of I to be greater than sigma of j. So if you write it in one line notation, basically what you want is you want to count all the pairs that decrease. So, for example, if I have 3, 2, 1, 4, the pairs that I'm counting are there's this pair, there's this pair, there's this pair. So there are 3 inversions here. And I'm saying that this length is the number of inversions. You can see that it's true at least for the generators, because these generators have one inversion, and obviously their minimal length is one. You can actually show that this is true in general. And so as a consequence, we can say that there exists a maximal length inversion. So, can anybody guess what this is?
So,
yeah, so it's going to be like the reverse, I guess. So it's going to be n times minus 1, because this maximizes the number of inversions that are possible. And a third property that's nice, I'll be kind of vague about it, is that it behaves well under concatenation and picking substrings. So if you write factorizations in this way, then if you basically like remove things or add things, it's going to behave in an expected way. There are some fundamental properties, like it's called like there's like an exchange property and a deletion property that basically talks about exactly these. But I won't get into it. So why have I brought this up? I will show you. So, what does this mean? This means that ei, ei plus 1, ei, ei plus 1, ei, ei plus 1 is equal to 1. I pull three of them to the other side, so I multiply by ei plus 1, ei, ei plus 1 on the right side. So I get ei, ei plus 1, ei is equal to ei, ei plus 1, ei. This one, ei, ej, ei, ej is equal to 1, do the same thing. EI, EJ is equal to EJ, EI.
I think your pluses are a little weird on that first one you did. I think you want the I plus 1s on the outside.
We define this equivalence relation based on these two, this equivalence relation based on what we can achieve with these two relations. And now what I'm saying is that these two relations also show up in Sn, and namely they're the only relations in Sn, apart from this one right here. And so what we get is that we can label these equivalence classes with elements in Sn because they have the same relations. Now, there's the question of here, what do we do with this one? Those two relations are only necessary for words that are not minimal length. And because every permutation has a minimal length factorization, just it has to be a minimal one, that means that these two relations are the only ones that we need. And that what we can say is that we can say equivalence classes can be labeled by minimum length factorizations of Sn. But this is just sigma in Sn because they're exactly the same.
It's a little bit weird, I admit.
So, because we have this sort of natural labeling happening here, the intuition is that this natural labeling gives you exactly the equivalence between the equivalence here that we want. So the claim is that using this structure, you can say, okay, we have everything that's possible here. We should probably have everything possible here. And how do you make this rigorous? You use something called the Drupal. So here, what this is that we can write GLN as the disjoint product, or disjoint union, sorry, of these double cosets. What is B? What is W? B is lower triangular matrices, and W is SN. But we're looking at SN embedded into GLN of R, so these are permutation matrices. And why? What is this from? What is this? This is from viewing GLN of R as an algebraic group. So it's like the Lie structure of GLN of R. And this is what we use to sort of cross that bridge from abstractly labeling things in SN to abstractly labeling these images of maps to SN and showing that this actually means something. And the thing to note, so these guys are called Ruha cells. Something you can prove easily, provided you know a little bit about what this looks like, is that the image of some sigma, because we're thinking about words as factorizations now, the image of some sigma is actually inside B sigma B. So what we have here is that these the sigmas that show up there actually represent something that's happening in this like structure, this like B structure. And because these are a form of disjoint union,
what is that?
We can keep it here.
Huh?
No, it's fine.
We'll have to remove the value.
Okay, so I guess just got done talking about the fact that the image of X sigma is inside the sigma B. And because these are partition the space of GLN, we can get a bunch of results that we were looking for this whole time. So we get that the image of X sigma is, and X gamma are disjoint. That's what we're looking for. And importantly, this means that there cannot be any more relations between things of different words. So if there were, then you would see that this has an intersection. And so the only thing that we have to worry about is whether these parameters actually, I guess, make sense. And by make sense, I mean that X sigma is a, say, caveat sigma as a reducer. So obviously, if it's something like this guy, it's not going to be a homomorphism. But when you say that this is minimal, then it is. And you use the same disjointness of this thing.
And can you just write down clearly, like, what topology it's a homomorphism for?
What topology is? It's R. So the homomorphism is between this and the image of X. And so typically they won't be written like this. They'll be. I guess another notation would be mu of sigma, but this is, I guess, what we call the Bruhasel in this totally non-negative case. So what we're saying is that the Bruhasels are homeomorphic to open balls. And, okay, what's the next thing that you might expect? You would say that these mu of sigma form a CW complex. This is, again, using the structure of this Bruhat decomposition, because the closures of these behave nicely. And how do they behave nicely? You can look at how it happens over there. But essentially, what you can notice is that U of sigma, well, we can write sigma as, like, you know, for example, E1, E2, E1, the closure of this contains U of, like, E1, E2. Right, because what we're doing is we're saying, we want to see the closure of this. We have these parameters that can be greater than zero. We just make them at least allow them to be zero. And so we set this E1 to be zero, and then we get that this is an enclosure. And so, in fact, this is exactly what you get. So, one more thing. So, you'd say that the closure is the disjoint union of gamma SN. Well, the gamma less than or equal to sigma. And this gamma is the subword order. So this is what you get when you just take out elements, take out letters from your factorization. This order is also called the strong Bruhat order. The name Bruhat pops up a lot of times in this talk. But we have exactly this. And so I'll note that this is Bruhat order. I'll say, therefore, the closure coset of the CW complex is equal to the Bruhat poset on SN. This thing is very well known, and it has a lot of nice properties. And with those properties, you can use that to prove that the collection of U sigma form the triangulation of a sphere. So this Bruhoff-O set has a few properties that are nice, namely it's Eulerian and shellable. I could explain those to you, but basically it suggests very heavily that topologically what's going on here is that you're triangulating a sphere. And then this intuition was proved by Hirsch after this thing was noticed. And the last thing that we can do, well, there's a lot more things that we can do, but we can use this to parameterize fully positive beliefs. A nice property of this Bruhoff decomposition is that the larger the word, so the more generators, the larger the length, the longer the length, the more minors that are positive. So, namely, what that means is that this guy, we can call it W0. Namely, BW0B gives you this totally positive matrix. Except you need a little bit more. What you need are these guys intersected with another. Remember how we were only dealing with EIs? Well, these are the FIs. And so what this means is that what we can get is our parameterization map, which, as you can see here, how many inversions are there here? This is n times n minus 1 over 2. That's how many parameters this side has. This side has another n times n minus 1 over 2. And then we have diagonal matrices here. So this is called a double group. So if you take these, and then you also add the n diagonal matrices. This gives you n squared parameters. And you need n squared parameters. And these n squared parameters give you a bijection from r n squared greater than 0. So while we don't exactly get a similar structure with totally positive matrices as we do with totally non-negative, it's sort of like just one cell, the top cell of like this large sort of internal matrix going on here. And that is the gist of what I am familiar with. What my research was focused on was generalizing everything here, everything that I've written down, to the case of K non-negative matrices. And K non-negative matrices are matrices where you only restrict some matrices of order K or smaller. And by Cauchy-Binet, that still gives you that it's a semigroup, and then you can do most of the same thing that you do here. And yeah, I guess that's my talk. Any questions?
So I'm a little confused about the how this, you're saying that this is exactly like the entire matrices or something like that?
I wrote it down, and then afterwards I was like, wait, maybe this is incorrect. No, what I'm saying is that these EIs and FIs and Hs can be with each other. So this is being imprecise. What I'm saying is that you can write any TP matrix as you can write it as this many EIs times this many FIs times this many HIs. And you can do it for each one of these because both of these have the same structure. This is like the FIs are just the transpose. So you get this exact same structure in both cases, as well as the diagonal matrices, which you need to, I guess, scale each individual row and column. And with all of these, you get any totally positive matrix. And the way that you can argue that is that, well, this lies in this cell. And the cell is the only one that can contain all of them. And so that's I was, I guess, in the reverse direction of my head, like I said imprecisely, but does that make sense? Anything?
So you said at the beginning that you couldn't like explicitly describe any methods to like generate. If you want an n by n totally positive matrix, you didn't have a way to do it. But there is there a known kind of concrete way to write down like a parameterized family where if I give you an n, then you can hand me an n by n totally positive matrix, or is it not known?
Yeah, you can do it with n squared parameters. So this is the way you do it. You just say. You can write down W0 as like the product of EIs.
You just trace it all out, basically.
Yeah, you just multiply all the matrices together.
Okay.
So this sort of question also ties into the problem of testing matrices to see if they're totally positive. Because the definition says every minor, right? But clearly, you don't need to test every single minor. For totally positive matrices, you only need to test n squared minors. And so this ties into the fact that those n squared minors give you the exact bijection between. It's not the same bijection, but they're very related, I guess.
Any more questions? All right, well, let's thank the speaker.